This is White Sox Weekly, your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago. Now here's your host, Connor McKnight.
Welcome in to White Sox Weekly. It is June 1st, although those of us here in the downtown Chicago area are going to have to wait just a little while longer to enjoy the very close to summer weather. A lot of rain here in Chicago. Fortunately, the White Sox are in Milwaukee, where I think there may also be rain in the forecast, but no matter. There's a roof on that park in Milwaukee, so we'll play baseball a little later this afternoon. White Sox Weekly with you, 312-332-3776. That's the phone number. Happy to have you jump on today. Talk White Sox, talk MLB. A lot of big national storylines in Major League Baseball here. And we're going to get to one of the biggest ones a little bit later on in the show. We'll talk about the expansion of Major League stats, the inclusion of the Negro League stats here into the MLB rule books, into the official database at MLB.com, and what that means and why it came about. It's an interesting story, no doubt about it. We'll get into the White Sox loss last night, their ninth straight loss, a 12-5 clubbing by the Milwaukee Brewers. 23 hits by the Brewers, a truly breathtaking offensive output, especially in that seventh inning when the Brewers put up 6 runs in the seventh. Another tough one for the White Sox, who are now 15-43 on the year. We've also got a good pitching matchup today with Robert Gasser for the Brewers, who you may not know much about. We'll tell you some about him. But Garrett Crochet will go for the White Sox, and that'll be a whole lot of fun. Always has been to watch him pitch. Even in the ball games where he's been hit around a little bit, Garrett Crochet's been fun to watch work. We'll talk with Michael Huff, the director of youth baseball for the White Sox, at 1 o'clock. We'll get his thoughts on the camps that you can get your kids to this summer, whether it be softball or baseball. We'll talk about this White Sox team and some of the big storylines around Major League Baseball, too. Gave you the phone number. Happy to have you jump in. Should also know, as we get things started here today, we say aloha, Sox fans, which means hello and goodbye. At the beginning of the show, we mean it in the hello version. Join us at the ballpark next Saturday, June 8th, as the Sox take on the Red Sox at 3:10 p.m. The first 20,000 fans in attendance will receive a Hawaiian shirt presented by Beggar's Pizza. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. That's whitesox.com/promos. All right, let's deal with last night, because it was a tough one. We're going to hear from some of the particulars from that ball game. We'll hear from White Sox manager Pedro Grifol. We'll hear from Danny Mendick. We'll hear from Eric Fetty, all of whom had some interesting evenings from different perspectives. You know, Fetty had come into the ball game. I don't know if you saw this. We mentioned it on the pregame show yesterday. Fetty had come into the ballgame, ranked by Baseball Reference Wins Above Replacement, B-War, for those of you who don't follow it necessarily as hardcore as others do. Wins Above Replacement is a thumbnail stat that means a lot more than just the single number, but also doesn't mean everything, right? And I don't want to get into a huge discourse about what and why Baseball Reference WAR is different than Fangraphs WAR. I don't even know that I necessarily could do it justice with an explanation. It's some pretty intense math, or at least more intense than I've got a degree for anyway. But Fetty came into the ballgame last night, third, with the third highest pitcher wins above replacement on baseballreference.com. A couple other starters had two guys had wins above replacement totals higher than Fetty. Seth Lugo was number one in baseball. Seth Lugo, the ace of the Royals, which feels crazy to say. Fetty went 5 innings, gave up 9 hits, 4 runs, 4 walks, and 8 strikeouts in that game. And it truth be told, the ballgame through 6 innings felt like one that was going to go back and forth all night long. The Brewers scored first. The White Sox took the lead back. The Brewers scored again for 3 innings. The White Sox took the lead back. The sixth inning, things quieted down. In fact, in that sixth, you know, the bases were loaded for the Brewers, but White Sox were able to get out of it. Tim Hill struck out a couple. Michael Soroka struck out a couple to get out of a big jam, and that was a big avoidance, a run avoidance scenario for the White Sox in that sixth. And instead of it being an exhale scenario where the White Sox had escaped danger, it turns out that the Brewers had plenty more for them in that seventh inning, putting up six. The White Sox went 1-2-3 in the sixth inning, striking out three straight times, 7, 8, and 9 hitters up, Paul DeJong and Danny Menick and Martin Maldonado. And then all hell broke loose in the bottom of the seventh, and the Brewers put up six runs. All that to say, Fetty battled. He kept his team in the ballgame. He has, for the most part this season, been the most reliable White Sox starter. I'm playing with it semantically just a little bit to leave room for Garrett Crochet, who's going to pitch today for the Sox, of course, and has been as dominant as almost anybody in baseball in specific starts. There is a three-start stretch where, of course, he gave up, you know, a whole bunch of runs and was kind of relearning how to attack hitters on the fly and as a starter. But other than that, you know, Crochet's been your guy. Fetty's been your most reliable guy. And that's kind of the White Sox rotation at this point, looking for sources of length in a ball game and some dominance in some other circumstances too. And the reason I bring it up with Fetty is kind of being able to reverse engineer what the Brewers did, right? I mean, the fact that Eric Fetty scattered 9 hits through 5 innings, also walked 4 and struck out 8 and was able to keep the run total at 4 was pretty impressive, especially when you look at what the Brewers were able to do to some of the White Sox medium leverage arms and higher leverage arms in the case of John Brebbia, who's really struggling here over the last couple of weeks. I mean, they put it on him. Soroka gave up 3, Brebbia gave up 3, and Schuster gave up 2, and he's been really good in long relief. 23 hits is a mind-boggling total, and none of them were home runs. 12 runs for the Brewers. They did not hit one over the fence. In fact, the only one that might have gone out, other than Paul DeJong's solo shot in the third inning, was Gavin Sheets, who nearly got one out over Blake Perkins, who was in center field for the Brewers. That was in the eighth inning. Those two were some of the harder hit baseballs of the night, despite the fact that the Brewers end up putting 23 hits. The batting average on balls in play, and a big credit to Jim Margulis of SoxMachine.com, who put this in the liner of his little game notes. Otherwise, I wouldn't have thought to calculate it. I really wouldn't have, so credit to him for doing it. The Brewers had a .658 batting average on balls in play for the night. That means that anything that fell in the field of play was a hit a little over 65% of the time. That's outrageous. I mean, it's crazy. The White Sox, we'll play Pedro Grifol's post-game comments first here in terms of the audio, because he talked about what's going to have to be looked at here. I get, and believe me, I'm the guy who sits here and says it's one of 162. You can't make huge judgments about one game at a time. And yet, when you've got a ball game where 23 hits are coming down, you're going to look at a couple of things. You're going to cinch up the belt a little bit. Make sure that the numbers are right. Make sure that the positioning charts were right. Make sure you printed out the right stuff for the ball game. You think I'm joking, but I'm kind of not. I mean, that's an outstanding total, 23 hits to allow. Maybe there's something that the White Sox got wrong in the approach that led to 23 as opposed to, I don't know, 15 or something like that. Let's take a listen real quickly here to White Sox manager Pedro Grifol and his comments after the ballgame last night. He allowed for some of that possibility and certainly mentioned the way the White Sox will go ahead and take a look at this game, basically from all facets of the organization. Here's Pedro.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we're going to look at it, of course. Not just us. I mean, our analytics department is going to look at it. And we get a report every, you know, after every game, you know, for tomorrow, you know, to see where those ground balls were and, you know, where we were and what have you. But, you know, overall, we've been okay. We've been right around, you know, average to maybe a tick above at times, a tick below at times, but we've been okay. Today was, you know, definitely something that we have to look at. And not just us on the video. I mean, this goes, you know, beyond us too. We got to look at the video for sure and see where we were, but we also got to look at the data and see what, you know, what happened. Because 20 singles is, you know, it's somewhat alarming, but we'll look at it. But I mean, this is the first game that happened that this happens. I got to give credit to them too, man. Those guys grinded it out at bats. They put the ball in play. They started the game really aggressive, swinging early. in the end of the game, just taking a ton of pitches and putting the ball in play, even when they were behind the count. So their offense, did a really good job. They ran the bases extremely well. It was an impressive game on their end, and at the same time, we had an opportunity. We took a 5-4 lead into the bottom of the seventh. So I was proud of our guys, for the energy that we had. We prepared well. Just one of those days. They found holes, a lot of holes.
As the losses kind of pile up, here all kind of in a row, how do these guys kind of fight the urge to try to change things up and with what they're doing, their work and stuff like that?
Oh, their work was phenomenal. Yeah. I mean, they got after it today prior to and early work, and their work's phenomenal. I mean, for the most part, I mean, every team works, man. It's beyond the work. It's at 7 o'clock when the game starts, and these guys brought their game. I mean, everybody did. And there was there was a ton of energy in that dugout. There was a will to win a baseball game today, and we just got beat. Pretty simple. We just got beat today by a really good team. So we got to find a way to break this losing streak. And like I said, you can dissect this thing tonight. We as coaches can dissect it tomorrow morning, but then we got to get ready to play at 3 o'clock. Tomorrow once that bell rings, it's a different ball game. We got to win the one tomorrow.
That's White Sox manager Pedro Grifol. They certainly do need to win this one today. That was his comments last night after the loss to the Brewers 12-5. Sox have lost 9 in a row. It's the longest losing streak since the 10-game losing streak last year that went, if memory serves, in from middle of May, end of April, middle of May, something like that. Either way, that's best left in the past and hopefully snapped in this afternoon's ball game. I think back to that approach by the Brewers, and Len and DJ did such a great job kind of cataloging it as the game went on. Whether it's a guy like Sal Frelick or Christian Yelich, who's got power, ended up with 5 hits and 5 RBI. Whether it's a guy like, I think I mentioned Frelick, Joey Ortiz, who played well in that game, Bryce Turang, who had a whole bunch of hits. The approach from each one of those players was a little bit different every time. They were able to choke up. They were able to go the other way. They were able to hit with 2 strikes. They attacked early in the count. And no, this isn't to say that the Milwaukee Brewers are the class of baseball when it comes to the offense, but they're certainly having one heck of a run. And it's not to say that the Brewers are the team to beat in the playoffs or anything like that, but when you look at the numbers and when you look at what's been accomplished to this point here as we start the month of June, you go ahead and sort by some of the totals, right? I mean, you go ahead and sort by some of the numbers that Brewers offense has put up, and I'll just give you, kind of where they're at in the ranks. In terms of total runs scored, runs batted in, the Milwaukee Brewers are 2nd in baseball. They've scored 281 RBI. They have struck out 509 times, which is a lot. It's the 8th highest total in baseball. But they've also walked 206 times, which is the 4th highest total in baseball. As a team, the Milwaukee Brewers have a 755 OPS. Only the Yankees, who employ both Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, and the Los Angeles Dodgers, who employ seemingly everyone else who is fantastic at baseball, have a better team OPS. I mean, it's kind of time to start looking at what the Brewers can do as a ball club, and if you're a Brewers fan, start wondering about what they might want to add come trade deadline time. As for the White Sox, you search by those same offensive numbers, and the Sox, unfortunately, are still last in baseball in team OPS with a 607, nearly 40 points behind the 29th-ranked team, the Miami Marlins. As a team, the Sox hit 215. As a team, they have a 277 on-base percentage. And as a team, they have a 330 slugging percentage. Those numbers, the slugging percentage is last in baseball. The on-base percentage is, let's see, 2nd to last in? Nope, last in baseball. And the average is last in baseball. So there's, offensively a lot of work for this team to do. And that's why last night, at least, a lot of different ways, feels as disappointing as it was, because 5 runs on 9 hits with a 2-for-8 night with runners in scoring position is a good night. I mean, for a lot of teams, not just the White Sox, who have been struggling so mightily here offensively. So to get that effort and then have the Brewers haul off on a 23-hit night with 12 runs is you know, a little bit demoralizing. I would imagine that just like every other team in baseball, though, momentum is the next day's starting pitcher, right? And for the White Sox, they've got their best, Garrett Crochet, certainly their most dominant, Garrett Crochet, going tonight. And that's a big thing for the Sox. We'll talk about what Garrett Crochet has been able to accomplish this year. We'll hear from Eric Fetty and Danny Mendick about the ball game last night. Michael Huff is our guest coming up at 1 o'clock. We'll talk to him about the efforts that White Sox Youth Baseball is making to get your kids involved in some outdoor activities out of the house and playing baseball and playing softball. We'll talk to Michael in just a little while here. This is White Sox Weekly on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox games, all of them, on the ESPN Chicago app.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight, getting you ready for the White Sox and Brewers game a little bit later this afternoon. 3:10 is our start time up in Milwaukee. I think they'll have the roof on, and we'll also have the pregame show at 2:30. Your phone calls, 312-332-3776. For the bulk of the afternoon, we're going to talk with Michael Huff, the director of youth baseball for the White Sox, in about 10 minutes here on the show. You can put your socks and sneakers to the test. Join us at Guaranteed Rate Field on Saturday, June 22nd, for our annual White Sox 5K presented by Illinois Corn Growers Association. Racers will cross the finish line on the field and then head up to the concourse area for a post-race party. All net proceeds benefit White Sox charities. Register today at whitesox.com/run. Now, the White Sox last night gave up 23 hits to the Brewers in a 12-5 loss. And the guy who started the ballgame, Eric Fetty, probably pitched as good as any one of the White Sox pitchers they employed last night. Tim Hill, Michael Soroka, John Brebbia, and Jared Schuster. He had to battle. That Brewers team came with a game plan. They were swinging early. And Eric Fetty talked about what he had to go through to keep his team in it for as long as he could last night. Here's Fetty after the Sox loss.
I was in head traffic all day. They made me work. I think just overall they had a lot of good at-bats. They didn't give anything away. Took good pitches and hit them where there were holes. Tough day.
Yeah, how hard is that to pitch, whether it's you or the bullpen or anybody, when an offense is just consistently finding the holes like you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, you just got to, step up your game, mix stuff up, maybe be a little unpredictable. It was, overall tough, felt like, was able to get out of some big jams, sometimes not, but, I kept the ball on the ground, a few balls left or right, maybe some double plays, and it's a totally different story.
I guess, how do you process where, the scoreboard is 23 hits, but it's also like there was very little in the air, very little drip in the air. Did you see that it's like that would even out over the long term, or is it?
I mean, it's part of baseball. Like I said, they took what was given to them. They tried to hit the ball the other way where there was holes. Some credit to them for sure. You don't accidentally usually get 23 hits, but just one of those things where, I think, as a pitcher, if you're trying to limit damage, balls on the ground are usually a good thing and, keep the slug down and overall, hopefully it evens out.
That's White Sox starter Eric Fetty from last night. You heard the voice of James Fegan, reporter for SoxMachine.com, asked that last question about, yes, it's 23 hits and that's brutal and tough to win with or tough to win against, but most of them are on the ground. Most of them are not exactly seeing eye singles. There was some exit velo behind him. Don't get it twisted, but you kept him from launching a bunch of home runs, and that's something in this day and age. I mean, certainly the batting average on balls in play shouldn't settle around 68% or 65%, whatever it was. Can you take that small victory? And you could almost hear Fetty laugh a little bit. Yes, but that's hard to do when you're wearing a ninth straight loss and it's a 12-5 defeat at the hands of the Milwaukee Brewers last night, as it was. It was a scary moment in the ballgame, too. Danny Mendick was hit by a pitch up around the jaw. The C-flap is the name of the protective add-on to that helmet that a lot of players wear. Most everybody wears one now. I guess there's a couple that don't, but most everybody wears the C-flap now. Came in vogue after Giancarlo Stanton was hit around the face and jaw, broke his jaw, starting to wear that piece for a little while. I know that there had been more before it, but I kind of think of Stanton. Let me know if you've got the patient zero for this. But I thought it was Stanton who started wearing that piece first, and then things got really popular afterward. Mendick was wearing that protective piece on the helmet, and it helped him get away with one last night. He spoke about the scary moment and also the loss to the Brewers. Here's Danny Mendick.
I didn't even see the video, but I think it caught the C-flip. I got some, the seams around the helmet, so that's where it hit it. Did you, when you went down, how did you feel when you went down?
I felt fine. It just kind of felt like, the helmet smacked up against me. So my face was a little swollen and cut my nose a little bit, but other than that, I didn't really, no issues, no headache, no nothing, so I feel good.
How tough is this getting for you guys?
It's tough. Tonight, what did they have, 20-something hits? It's like, they just found every hole, and it's hard, these guys just felt like everything's going their way right now, so we had a lead there for a little bit, and then they just kept hitting, but wherever we were, we're worked. But it is what it is.
You're seeing it like that in terms of, when you got the big hit total, but so few of it was in the air, and it's all, punched to the ground. What was it kind of like being out there? Was it just fighting holes that consistent?
Yeah, it's tough. Like I said, it seems like everywhere that you play, they're not. Everywhere we play, then the ball gets hit where we're not. It's like, do we have to move? Do we have to make an adjustment or something like that? But, it seems like this has kind of been the thing that they've been doing for the past week or so, where they just get a ton of hits. So I think we're going to make an adjustment, but we'll see.
That's White Sox third baseman last night. He'll be at second base tonight. The lineups are out for the White Sox and Brewers. That's Danny Mendick. Yeah, you would imagine that some sort of adjustment's going to be made one way or the other. Even if it's a half step to your left as opposed to being where you think you're supposed to, whatever it is, it's a lot of hits to give up last night for the White Sox. Here's the lineup. Tommy Pham leads off. He's in center field. Corey Lee will catch and bat second. Corey Jolks is in right field batting third. Paul DeJong, who homered last night, will DH and bat four. Gavin Sheets at first base batting five. Another day off for Andrew Vaughn. Lenin Sosa in at third base. He was just called up to the White Sox the other day. We'll talk with Michael Huff about the optioning of Brian Ramos and bringing Lenin Sosa up to the roster here in just a couple of minutes. 7, 8, and 9 for the White Sox are Andrew Benintendi in left field. Danny Mendick is in the lineup but playing second base tonight. And Zach Remillard gets shortstop with Paul DeJong, the designated hitter. Remillard batting 9 and playing short for the Sox. They're all opposing Robert Gasser, who's a pretty good one, or at least gotten off to a good start. One of the Brewers' top 10 prospects, a lefty arm who doesn't throw all that hard. A guy named Robert Gasser should throw 98. I completely understand that. I'm with you. Ben Lindbergh of The Ringer and the Effectively Wild podcast has called it nominative determinism quite a bit. Your name kind of determines who you are. That's sort of Robert Gasser. You think he should throw really hard. He's 2-0 with a 196. Garrett Crochet, who doesn't have a whole lot of nominative determinism to him at all, unless he actually crochets, which I don't think he does. I think he knits. I don't think he crochets, and those are two different disciplines. But Crochet throws harder than Gasser. You can figure that one out. We'll all watch it coming up at 3:10 this afternoon, and we'll be listening to Len and DJ the entire time. White Sox Director of Youth Baseball Michael Huff will join us on the other side of a quick break. I'm Connor McKnight. You're listening to White Sox Weekly on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Black and Abdallah weekdays at 6:30 ESPN Chicago.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. Be the first to shop the Chicago White Sox and Alice and Wonder Limited Retail Collection at the Chicago Sports Depot next Sunday, June 9th, as the White Sox take on the Red Sox at 1:10 p.m. The collection includes adult and youth apparel, novelty items, plus the option to customize your own hat. For more information, visit whitesox.com/AliceAndWonder. We'll be joined by our guest this afternoon, Michael Huff, in just 10 seconds. We'll pause it here for station identification.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WSHE HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Michael Huff is the director of youth baseball for the Chicago White Sox. He joins us here on White Sox Weekly, as he normally does, as we get closer and closer to the start of youth camps. WhiteSox.com/play is the website. And Michael, as I scroll through the website here, I think one of my favorite things is zooming in and out of the map of the Chicagoland area with all the different Sox logos announcing each and every one of the camps. They're everywhere. They're absolutely everywhere. If you wanted to, you could probably hit every single camp and then tour the entire Chicagoland area all at the same time. It's awesome.
Well, the fun thing is that for those families that go to multiple spots, they get to try little different restaurants, little hole-in-the-wall places to eat. So like you said, you can mix a Chicagoland dining experience. What's best in the northwest suburbs all the way out in Elgin versus what's the best local fare down in Crown Point, Indiana. So, no, Connor, it's very good. You're right. It starts next week, which is kind of crazy, and then it's 10, 11 weeks of a lot of chaos and a lot of fun for kids doing these camps from 9 in the morning till 12 or from 1 to 4 in the afternoons.
They are in over 38 communities throughout the Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana for kids from 5 to 12 and for everybody, right? I mean, it's all level, yep, all levels of baseball play, and it's softball, yep, too, which I think is a great thing.
Yeah, and we will always start day one on Mondays breaking up the kids sort of age-wise, but typically by the end of that Monday, you're moving boys or girls up or down a group. If it's, as you know, as we've talked about, you know, it's the youngest son of five boys in a family who's six. Well, guess what? He's going to be playing with the eight-year-olds by the end of Monday because he just knows how to. Likewise, if there's boys or girls that need to move up or down, we're able to do that. So typically by Tuesday through Wednesday and Thursday, the kids are playing with the group that are their aptitude, that they can hang with, and then our coaches are able to push those kids as best they can. Really heavy Monday, Tuesday with instruction, a little bit of fun, a little bit of games on Tuesday, then Wednesday, Thursday, it's sort of 50-50, adding on, progressively building on the instruction, the fundamentals portions, but a lot more games and a lot more giggles and laughs for the kids.
You've been doing this for a while. I wonder, what is the biggest change in youth coaching here in the last 5-10 years that you're going to kind of see? Like maybe you had a 15-year-old who went through, and then a couple years later you have another child. He's like maybe 8 or something like that. What's the big change you're going to see from over the last 10 years?
I think the big change I see, and something again we've talked about on previous shows, is the specialization of sports, which something we do not promote at all. Our travel teams, the AI-9 travel teams, the 13, 14-year-olds, our high school kids, we encourage, almost expect our kids to play multiple sports. And when we have these new 8-year-olds that are coming in, and our coaches and I, Dan Pasqua, again, former teammate of mine with the White Sox, who's out at these camps, you know, starts to connect with the kids, we hear a lot more that this is the only thing they're doing. And we almost seek out their parents and talk to them at the end of Monday or Tuesday to say, don't do this. Like, let them play multiple things. Their bodies need to grow, develop in multiple ways. But I would say the one thing that we're seeing the most of is that specialization, which we really do not espouse at all.
You know, it's funny. I'll peel back the curtain a little bit. Michael works as an analyst at the Big Ten Network for a lot of baseball coverage that they do, and you're fantastic at it. And I had a chance to work over at the Big Ten as well. And in doing some research for some of the games I did play-by-play for, you know, I knew this but didn't really know it until I kind of scrolled through and looked at individual player bios. There, I mean, I couldn't find a single Big Ten baseball player that only, like, every single kid had also a four-time letter winner in football, or also played,
yep,
basketball, or,
yep,
let's see, I think it was Connor Cascanet, or maybe it was Joe Stevens,
yeah,
on Purdue.
Great catcher at Purdue, yeah.
Right. Volleyball, swimming, lacrosse, and everything, yep, else, right? It's like a 9-athlete kid. And this is, if your kid is heading that way, whether it's D1 or D2 or what have you, it seems more and more that those coaches are looking for players, like actively seeking out players that have that multi-sport background.
Yeah, for our travel teams especially, our travel, the White Sox Elite, Inner City, the White Sox Ace, our tryouts will be in the middle of June, I want to say around June 15th, July 15th, at Bennett Academy. But literally, as we're reading resumes on kids that are trying out for us, and it's the overwhelming majority of kids who play for us are those multi-sport athletes. I think the parents are a little bit surprised when our coaches, again, the Scott Lawlers, the Jim Aducis of the world are like, no, it's fine that he plays football. No, it's fine that he plays basketball. Here's what we're going to want to do and work around those. But as those guys, the Jim Aducis, are getting the phone calls from the colleges, Jim constantly says to me, one of the first things that comes out of every college coach's mouth is, what else does this kid do?
Yeah.
And, you know, as much as we're able to say, oh, yeah, he also plays football, also plays soccer, also plays basketball, does a little bit of lacrosse, or did this up until this last year because he's realizing he's ready to make that serious commitment because he's a junior or senior in high school, those college coaches' ears perk up and they just get excited. And I know because we have a bunch of high school coaches and retired high school coaches that work with us at that elite level. All of those guys, again, they talk amongst themselves and obviously with me saying, yeah, we're looking for those kids that are coming out of middle school that are playing 2, 3, you know, 4 sports and are constantly on the go, building muscles from different skill sets. And now when I get to high school, we're hoping to pare them down from 4 sports maybe to 2 and then really start to see their bodies start to grow, mature, develop so that with those 2 sports in high school, that it their natural ability will take them to that route in college if that's something that they want to do. We don't have to force something to say, you should be a baseball player. It's like, no, your body is saying football. You need to leave us after next year and go play football at Notre Dame. Like, you're growing too much. You're getting too big. Your body, yeah, go. You love both sports. Football is where you belong. Likewise, same with the baseball. Like, the bodies and the athleticism will dictate typically where the kids will gravitate toward if it's even beyond high school. But the frustrating thing, getting back to your initial question, frustrating thing is we start to see too much at the younger ages where parents are saying, well, we know my kid loves baseball right now. It's like, well, of course, he's playing with his friends. He's outside. He's 9 years old. Well, but he's going to be, again, the next Jim Aducey, Mike Huff, Jim Tomey, whatever it is. And you know, we're scratching our heads like, really? Really? No, why don't we just let him play? We'll teach him how to have a lot more fun with baseball, but I'm pretty sure he should be doing other things and letting kind of Mother Nature take its course.
If you're a parent nodding along right now in your car thinking, oh, this makes a whole lot of sense, we're talking with Michael Huff, the director of youth baseball for the White Sox, and you can join a camp. Go to whitesox.com/play. They are all over the Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana community, and they start in just a little bit here. We're getting things fired up.
Yeah, next week. We got 4 next week, and then it's 6 camps a week, typically 2 up north, 2 sort of central western suburbs, and then 2 southern suburbs of Chicago or northwest Indiana. So we try to sprinkle out. So each week, parents, if not in your community, hopefully it's just a 10, 15 minute drive to the town next to you to have your son or daughter join us.
And whitesox.com/play is the website. Michael, I was watching last night's game for the White Sox. Unfortunately, the Brewers mounted up with 23 hits. It actually, it kind of felt a little bit like a college game or like a high-level travel team because there weren't a lot of home runs. Players were moving the baseball all over the place. Paul DeJong went yard for the White Sox, his team-leading 8th. So there's your long ball for the night. But I wonder, you know, from your perspective, both having coached and played at very high levels and played outfield in the major leagues, Danny Mendick, we just played the cut last segment, talking about kind of making some adjustments and kind of understanding where the ball is going to go and what the Brewers are trying to do. Pedro Grifol talked about that a little bit last night. What do those adjustments look like from day to day in the bigs? Like, what sorts of things will the White Sox get up to just to alter the approach a little bit and hopefully keep the Brewers to under, I don't know, 15 hits?
Right. Well, when you see a team like the Brewers, and again, you did a great job this year in the Big Ten Network. It's like, it feels like a team like Nebraska who won the Big Ten tournament, that they have one guy that hit over 10 home runs, but they have 9 or 10 guys that can hit doubles, singles, triples to all parts of the ballpark. So when we would have a series against a team back when I played, and all of a sudden you began to realize these guys are just hitting it where the ball is pitched, we would literally, to your point, second game start to say, all right, Jack McDowell, we know you can pitch inside, outside, but these guys are just hitting it where you're pitching. We want you to pitch outer half the entire game. And everyone, we're going to start to slide toward right center for the right-handed hitters, left center to the left-handed hitters, and just overload that side of the field with who we think are the guys that are going to be making the plays defensively. Again, tip your cap to Milwaukee, just continuing to find a way to be in a division that clearly they do not have the most talent, and clearly they are playing the best baseball. And a lot of that has to go with guys not trying to do too much and just trusting what their strengths are. And when you have a lineup like Milwaukee that doesn't have seven guys that look like they could, you know, hit a baseball 500 feet, they're fine with taking singles, and they're fine with hitting the opposite way. And so for us, when we would play in the majors and look at a team that was on a roll like that, we would just try to say, all right, we're going to pitch you this way, but we're also going to play you that way. And more often than not, with the White Sox and the Blue Jays, we had more success than not.
It's funny in this day and age, too. You see by and large kind of one offensive approach in Major League Baseball with slight variations throughout. And the Brewers, at least last night, looked like, you know, kind of this old school kind of approach, sort of that early 90s, late 80s kind of thing. The flip side of that, though, is once you get adjusted to, right, like you're talking about with McDowell pitching outside, then you either have to, as a team, decide to hang with the approach, right, or try and hit for power, whether that's moving in some of your, you know, some of the big boppers that you might have into the lineup and trying to blast one or two. And things can dry up on an offense like that a little bit, right?
Yes, yes. If all of a sudden, you know, I'll always remember my first year with Cleveland, you know, the center fielder that just covers a lot of ground, and them saying, all right, we're playing the Yankees, you're playing left. I'm like, left? They go, yeah, because we have Swindell on the mound, Greg Swindell, who's a great pitcher. He can throw it where he wants to, and the Yankees are so good. We want you moving here. Like, you're going to be in eight different spots in left field. Center field, you're just moving a little bit left or right, so we don't need someone smart. We need you moving all around here. And for Don Mattingly, it's like, we need you moving in toward the infield, over toward the line. And I'm like, Don Mattingly, the guy that has hit eight home runs in eight games consecutively, you want me to shade him in and over to the line? They're like, yeah. I'm like, Don Mattingly, the guy that hits all, they're like, Mike, stop overthinking this. Yes. And Greg Swindell would just throw a fastball up and away, and Mattingly hit three line drives that I took one step one way, one step line drive outs. Next game, he now is saying, okay, I'm going to try to pull an outside pitch, or I'm going to try to hit an outside pitch up the middle, just not hit it the other way, because I'm just like playing catch with my cuff and I don't like making outs. Now, that can work short term. That's going to get him and a good hitter out of their rhythm, and they will have more failures than success. But clearly Cleveland saw something against the Yankees, and ironically we had pretty good success against a really good team because our pitchers were good enough to do that. For a hitter, yes, you may have to move up in the box, move back in the box, get a little bit closer to the plate and say, hey, on that outside pitch, I want to think of going up the middle, because then I'm breaking the shift, but not going too much where you're still not barreling it up. So those are some of the games within the games once you get to the major league level.
That's good stuff. I wonder if you can kind of apply that game within the game to Brian Ramos a little bit. We saw him come up and swing the bat really well. He got great results, hitting .318 with a .330 on base percentage in his first seven or eight games. Had the quad tweak and then, you know, really struggled afterward. He is now hitting really well in a couple of games at Triple-A Charlotte. That, after all, is a promotion from him. He came up from Double-A. How do you think about a player who makes that jump from a player dev standpoint? And what did you think of Brian Ramos in the 15 games we saw him?
Well, loved what I saw. I'm hesitant to see that type of jump within the Sox system right now, because I want these guys getting the at-bats at Double-A, getting the at-bats at Triple-A before they make that jump to the major leagues. And I think he saw just how quickly, if you are not 100%, if you don't have your timing down, how quickly the other team can overmatch you, even with not better pitchers with better stuff, but just being able to throw to locations when you're not 100%, you're going to get out. And so I was glad, they, sat him down. I'm glad they sent him back to the minors, AAA, just to get healthy and just to try to find that feeling of success again. So my hope is when he comes back, we see what we saw in those first few games, that he stays within himself, doesn't try to do too much, but starts to ride that feeling of here's how I can still play my game at the major league level and not try to do too much stuff and have success. And then don't try to, again, you're not Gavin Sheets. You're not going to hit a baseball a country mile. You're not this big, strong dude. Just play within yourself and trust that one person is not going to necessarily turn the season around. But if you play within yourself, eventually Getsy's going to get enough guys around you that play like you that we're going to have all of a sudden 6-7 guys that are able to hit 300, not just a couple guys that are able to hit 300.
Michael, appreciate you as always. A great conversation. And remember, whitesox.com/play is how you can get your kids signed up to learn baseball from the best in the Chicagoland area this summer. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much, Connor. Have a great day.
Always a pleasure. You too. Avoid the rain. You heard Michael talk about Brian Ramos there and kind of playing within himself. I think it seems to be that whatever lessons Brian learned with the struggles at the big league level, they seem to be taking hold here in Charlotte, at least in the early going. The Knights trail the Woo Sox right now 5-3, but Brian Ramos is 2-for-2, hitting .533 in three games down, well, 2.5 games down there right now, with a 1,200 OPS. So that's good. Lesson learned. Great to see him hit the ground running at AAA. Braden Shumake left that game. I'm not entirely sure why. The White Sox obviously called up Lenin Sosa, and he's starting today. I don't think we're looking for hug watch or anything like that at this point. And I'm just scrolling through the game feed as best I can, making sure that there wasn't an injury that I can note or anything like that. Again, it's a AAA game, and we've been on here on doing the show and talking with Michael Huff the entire afternoon. So you may have seen something that I didn't if you're watching that minor league game. If you did, give us a ring and let us know. Shumake removed from that ball game, and Brian Ramos went from third base to second base. Still, he's 2-for-2. Of note in that game, Luis Robert Jr. He's playing center field. We'll talk about him and his potential return to the White Sox and what it'll mean, how much you'd love to see it when we come back. I'm Connor McKnight. It's White Sox Weekly on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
All right, so there we were, cruising through the new open-air zoo, when I realized that the park was closing in like 15 minutes. Luckily, we were in my Nissan Rogue with its powerful VC turbo engine. Well, we had time to see all the animals. Whoa! And outrun a few!
Drive the Nissan Rogue.
Follow ESPN 1000 Chicago on YouTube.
Welcome back. It's White Sox Weekly here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight. We got a ball game this afternoon, a 3:10 start for the White Sox and Brewers up at American Family Field in Milwaukee. It does still feel strange for me to say it that way, but it is. That's what they call it. I love that ballpark. I really do. I grew up in the Wisconsin area, went to high school about an hour and a half north of Milwaukee, and would make the trek down to that ballpark quite often to see everybody coming into the team or coming into the ballpark, all sorts of different teams. Don't ever consider myself a Brewers fan growing up when I was a kid, but I really enjoyed going to that ballpark. It was a ton of fun. And when I was young, the Brewers weren't all that good, so the seats were plentiful. You could get $2 euchre seats. Those were the obstructed view seats way up in the back row, and walk yourself down to whatever spot you wanted to and watch your favorite players come through Milwaukee. It was a lot of fun. I enjoy that ballpark, and as I gather, there are a host, just a huge amount of White Sox fans who are making the trek up to Milwaukee this weekend to enjoy the different tailgating cultures that they have up in Milwaukee. Not the Whites. I mean, listen, White Sox have a whole huge tailgate culture themselves. I have walked amongst the tailgates. I have seen you grilling. It is fantastic. Wisconsin does it a little different, but they are proud and they are out there. You've got all sorts of different restaurants and river walks and stuff up there in Milwaukee. So if you are a White Sox fan heading up, thanks so much for listening. And have yourself a grand old time in Milwaukee. Enjoy the ball game today and root hard for the White Sox. And say hey to Len and DJ for me when you see them up there at American Family Field. The ball game last night was one thing. The coming baseball for the White Sox is another. And I get that kind of makes sense considering the Sox are 15-43 and there has not been a lot to root for here. There have been positive storylines, no doubt, mostly on the pitching side of things with Garrett Crochet and Eric Fetty. But there are some position players on the come that we may see at some point here later in the summer. We'll talk about one we already know, Luis Robert Jr., in just a little bit. But we'll head out to the phone lines here. 312-332-3776. That's the phone number. And on the south side, it's Ron. A ray of sunshine here on a gloomy Chicago day. Hi, Ron. How you doing, man?
Hey, Connor, look here. We talk about it when they're good. We talk about it when they're struggling.
No doubt.
That's what we've been doing. So this is what I wanted to mention. I am optimistic about the young pitching prospects coming through the system, ones particularly Birmingham. Mm-hmm. But kind of the thing that I'm a little disappointed is about position player development. You know, the player I was really looking forward to that he came from Arizona, and I thought he had some talent, was Dominic Fletcher. That hasn't panned out. Then I heard them mention Oscar Colas again. It's a little frustrating, and I hope Brian Ramos can get together. I look forward to the future with him and Coach Montgomery on the left side. But that's my thing, because right now you still don't have a real right field. You really don't have a second baseman. So those position players, the White Sox are still having a hard time developing. So those are my things. But always like to be optimistic, and I'm really optimistic about the pitchers, but a little disappointed about some of the position player development. Always,
yeah,
Ron, a pleasure, Connor.
Well, always, Ron. You know that. Call anytime. Yeah, I completely understand where you're coming from, and I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, listen, we're getting close to the draft, right? I think it's July. Oh, gosh. It's right around my 12th or the 14th or something like that. I could Google it, but I can't type and talk at the same time. It's my curse. You got the draft coming up in a little bit. And we'll have our chance here on White Sox Weekly to talk to Mike Shirley, the director of amateur draft for the White Sox, and get kind of his thoughts on things. When I talked to him last season, and although the White Sox drafted a senior shortstop in Jacob Gonzalez, who was just recently promoted to Double-A Birmingham and looking a hell of a lot better than he did last season after playing a full college season. I don't think Mississippi State made the College World Series last year. Not Mississippi State. He went to Ole Miss, not Mississippi State. He still played a lot of college baseball. And the swing changes that have kind of taken hold here in the offseason, we talked to Josh Barfield about this last week on White Sox Weekly, have really started to work for Gonzalez. And you've seen things, from him really start to blossom. All of that to say that Shirley talked a lot when we spoke last year about his, his love of the high school player, the high school prospect. And this coming draft, from what I understand, I would not call myself at all a draft expert in Major League Baseball. We do the research leading up to the draft, and we've certainly got everything for you once these picks are made, and we've got these players researched, and we talk to them here on White Sox Weekly. But, doing this job, it is difficult to keep an eye on both the prospects and the draft, the prospects that are in the Sox system and the draft and the ball game and all that kind of stuff. So something has to kind of fall to the wayside. And for me, just the way I do the gig, it's MLB draft stuff. And that I kind of ramp up and crash course study and, do the cram sessions leading up to the draft. From what I understand, this is not a draft that's replete with high school players, with prep players. It's a really heavy college draft. And it's a college draft that, whether it's the kid from Georgia who's coming close to 40 home runs on the season, or Travis Pizzana, I believe is Oregon State, these are players who aren't up-the-middle players. These are corner guys or players who are right now playing a premium position but are almost assuredly going to move off that spot, whether it's shortstop to second base or short to third or even from left field or right field to a first base spot. That's what the thought is. Charlie Condon, I think, is the name of the guy at Georgia who may go 1-1. That's kind of the situation with him, despite the fact that he's got a ridiculous power bat and has had an incredible collegiate season this year. But when you talk about developing players, what my preference would be, and I think what the preference would be for a lot of farm directors and general managers, is to stock the entire system with as many shortstops as you can, because as that player ages, he is either going to A, lose some athleticism and have to move off of short, or B, you will have too many shortstops, and you will then be able to teach one of the better athletes in your system to play a easier, in quotes, defensive position, and that'll be just fine, thank you, because you'll have all that athleticism playing right or left or third or second or even first or something like that. I mean, the Padres have been doing this for years, right? I mean, how many shortstops do they have? And yes, they've had to deal with a whole lot of injuries and PED suspensions and whatnot Tatis Jr. out there, but you know, you move him to other spots, you move those players to other spots, and usually defensively, they still see the benefits. I mean, one of the guys who's having a great season this year is Jurickson Profar, who was an international signee at, I think it was like 16 or 17, burst onto the scene as baseball's top prospect at age 19, struggled, I mean, really struggled. And now, you know, after 10, 12 years in the big leagues, he's one of the best hitters going right now. It's a crazy story. We'll get into it at some point later. But that's a former shortstop playing a corner outfield spot and being okay at it, but bringing a bat that works. I from a player development standpoint, a position player development standpoint, it is true that the White Sox, whether they're either as you look at them currently comprised or years back, right, are dealing with a development side that has failed in some regards, in a development side that hasn't exactly gotten everything out of the player that you'd like, right? I mean, Andrew Vaughn is struggling at this point, third overall pick. Gavin Sheets, a second-round pick, certainly a useful player and having a very good season, a great walk rate season, but he is not pounding the ball out of the ballpark the way that you'd think or hope, rather, that profile would. What the White Sox see differently in players like Colson Montgomery and Brian Ramos, who are both down at AAA Charlotte right now and having a nice day, by the way. Ramos is 2-for-3. Montgomery's 1-for-2 with a couple batted in. The Knights are playing the Worcester Red Sox right now. And Montgomery has really started to turn things around here in the last week and a half or so after a tough start at AAA. But what they see differently in these players are a bit more ceiling, I think, than the high floor kind of ideas that perhaps they'd drafted with in years past. I'm not talking about the last three drafts or even four to that matter, but I'm talking about, you know, that your 2016s and 17s and 18 draft, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe even going up to 2020. Still, I was really impressed talking to Brian Ramos when we had a chance to do so on White Sox Weekly, because he knew that being up at the major league level, being called up from AA, was his opportunity to learn a lot and see how things went and change the approach some. It's almost like he knew that, and I suppose at some level all players do know that the adjustment is coming after they have some success, that pitchers are going to pitch him differently, that he's going to have to change some things. But Ramos knew that was coming even before he got hot, right? Then did for about 8 or 9 games, then got hurt, then struggled dealing with some of those changes in approach that he had to deal with. And from what I can tell and from what people said when he got down to AAA Charlotte, he was treating that as the next opportunity. And it's a promotion for him, after all. That's something Pedro talked about the other night. And Ramos just seems like a guy who's like, you know, center of the clubhouse kind of guy, you know, all about positive energy, all about moving things forward to the next day, all that kind of stuff. I was truly impressed by how smart he was and how fun he was to just kind of hang around with and be with there in the dugout for the 10, 15 minutes we had to talk with him. The results, at least down at AAA Charlotte, speak for themselves. He's hitting .500 in a couple of games. And who's to know, who's to say, rather, whether third base is the spot for him defensively? I certainly think it could be. Some concerns, I suppose, about the throwing, about his arm Some of that could be ironed out with footwork. Some of it gets ironed out with more reps. And some of it just gets, you know, ironed out by throwing the baseball, right? Just like making that throw and learning how that throwing motion works for you. Still, I think Ramos and Montgomery on the left side of the infield here for a while will be the things that the White Sox look forward to positionally. There will be another player I would expect on the position side that gets drafted here in July that we'll be talking about with similar kind of height, right? The White Sox have the fifth pick in the draft coming up here in July. And there's one more player that the White Sox will add to the roster here in the next few days that we've all seen play at league level highs, at near MVP vote getting highs. We'll talk about the return of Luis Robert Jr. soon here when we come back from a break on White Sox Weekly. I'm Connor McKnight. You've got the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Stream the games live on the ESPN Chicago app.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. You're on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight. You can enter the Ultimate Fan Sweepstakes for your chance to attend Chicago's hottest summer events. June's winner will get two field pass tickets to the Jordan Davis postgame concert presented by Coca-Cola on June 28th, plus two tickets to Lollapalooza, Riot Fest, and Chicago's NASCAR weekend. It's almost not to be believed, but we're giving them to you. To enter, visit whitesox.com/sweepstakes. That's whitesox.com/sweepstakes. So it sounds like that there are pending roster moves for the White Sox. Maybe pending's putting it a little too stridently, maybe. It sounds like it's entirely possible that come Tuesday, when the White Sox face the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field on the north side of Chicago, that Luis Robert Jr. may well be in uniform for the White Sox and ready to go. He is at AAA Charlotte right now. The Knights are playing the Woo Sox, the Wooster Sox. Robert is 1-for-3. He's got two runs driven in. He had a 2-RBI single, it looks like, did Luis Robert Jr. He homered in his first game. Overall, he's hitting 133. I think he took an 0-for-5 with a couple of strikeouts yesterday. It is unimportant what the results are for Luis Robert Jr. You would like to see walks and not strikeouts. You know, you would like to see homers and not groundouts, that kind of idea. But it's really, at this point, with Robert, about two things. You know, first and foremost, are you healthy? How's the hip feeling? It was a pretty serious injury that he dealt with that has kept him out since the very early part of the season. And, you know, it's clear that not having Robert in this lineup completely changes the way opposing pitchers can face the White Sox. They are the only team, I believe, without having accepted an intentional walk. I saw that earlier today on a White Sox beat reporter's post on Twitter, and for the life of me, I can't remember who posted it. My apologies. I like to credit every time, and for this one, I didn't write it down, and it's bad work by Connor. Sorry, guys. But they haven't been intentionally walked this year, and a big part of that is because there's not enough power in this lineup, perhaps. There's not enough on-base percentage in this lineup, perhaps. And while Luis Robert Jr. is not necessarily an on-base percentage machine, what he is, when he's right, is a guy who's got enough pop for everybody to go around. The run he went on at points last season, and it was wild to watch Robert last year for me. It really was. Because despite the fact that he finished, 11th in MVP voting? He got himself some votes, I know that. He didn't have a full season of Luis Robert-type work. He finished 12th in MVP voting. The first month, maybe even 8 weeks of the season, weren't great for Robert. He was benched. He was kind of had a come-to-Jesus meeting with his manager the first time around and then left that meeting and took off. I mean, from May 2nd all the way up until, let's call it June 30th, right? A .302 average with a .658 slugging percentage. In the month of July, he, you know, cooled off a little bit, but still hit .266 with a .300 on base and slugged .521. The White Sox would really go for a hitter like that in their lineup right now. Just the guy that Robert was in July would make a huge difference to this White Sox lineup. in the month of August for the White Sox last year, Luis Robert did, you know, kind of the same sort of deal, just kind of treaded water a little bit, but still had himself some good home run numbers, six of them in total, carried a .281 average and a .337 on base. And, you know, sometimes for guys who swing a lot like Robert do, right, the high strikeout total home run hitter sort of thing. And I think putting Robert in that one category and not thinking about the rest of his skill set shorts him a little bit. But we'll do it just for now, knowing that we're cheating some. I think Robert is one of those players who gets better pitches to lay off of, who can more easily identify the sliders that are going to be low and away and not to chase them when he's on a better power stretch, when he's really kind of clicking, because pitchers are so afraid of what he can do. And really in any counts. One of the things that impressed me most about Robert was back in 2022, I think is what it was. He was facing Justin Verlander. And if you've heard me tell this story, I apologize. But hearing about Luis Robert Jr. being great is always fun. He was facing Justin Verlander. And Verlander throws, I think it's ball one, outside on a high fastball, then drops a gross slider, low, outside corner for a perfect strike. And Robert swings and misses. And it's just it's a beautiful pitch. He drops the next slider right there, 0-2, boom, there it is, swings and misses, throws the next one a fastball high and away, just to see if he'll chase it. He didn't. Robert held off that one, then tried to throw the next slider, you know, the low and away, get the chase, get the punch out, we'll see what happens. Robert sees it coming, pitches off the plate even a little bit, but because Robert has outguessed Verlander, and because he's got great bat speed, and because he's got good enough plate coverage, kind of leans out over the plate, and absolutely yanks this ball, a low outside slider, deep into the Crawford boxes in Houston. And it was a beautiful at bat. I mean, it was truly something where Robert had, you know, beaten Verlander. It's something where even though Verlander kind of won the battle with those two sliders, Robert won the war. And I think, you know, that kind of approach, that kind of skill set is so eye-popping with Robert. Then you add in what he's capable of doing defensively, you know, the gold glove level center field play, and he's a game changer. He's got to stay healthy, though. And it's so easy to say, it's so simple to say, but being on field, availability is the best ability, right? I mean, you can't hit homers, you can't rob them, you can't make diving catches, you can't beat out infield singles if you're not able to run the way you want to. And you know, I think obviously when Robert was, you know, assigned to AAA Charlotte after having played five, six, whatever it was, seven games, I think, in the Arizona Complex League, he wasn't going to Charlotte unless and until the hip felt great. I would imagine that he's probably got a certain point. He's got to get out of the way of the idea, okay, is this right? You know, it feels right. Everything feels good. But I've got to know it responds, the hip, the way it needs to respond when I ask it to. Whether that's a quick break in center field and getting back on a baseball, whether it's hitting a soft ground ball to third and knowing that you've got to take off out of the box to try and beat it out for an infield single, all those kinds of things. I don't know where he's at in that checklist. I would imagine the White Sox do at some point, but Robert may not know yet. He may not have had each one of those circumstances pop up where he's been able to get that mental checklist all settled. It's kind of a scary thing at this point, and I think we can talk honestly about it because it's something White Sox fans have seen often enough, whether it be Robert or Eloy Jimenez or Yoan Moncada or Tim Anderson or whomever it is. There have been injuries that have popped up for this team, and they are not the only squad that have had to deal with a lot of soft tissue injuries, despite the fact that some Twitters may tell you so. This is something that a lot of teams are dealing with. When we talked with Michael Huff earlier in the show about the specialization of baseball players and how important it is for youth athletes to play multiple sports, it is about a lot of things. But as you get higher and higher in levels, that specialization becomes much more difficult to stay healthy with. And that's why, you know, your sports sciences, your trainers, and all this other stuff, that's why they're so crucial to an organization, because after all, you keep doing the same thing over and over again every day, you're going to have wear and tear because you're not kind of varying the use on that body. That's all I know about athletic training. That's all I know about, you know, keeping a body healthy through a baseball season. But it is known. That is a thing that we know. It for Robert and for a lot of athletes, you know, being that size and that shape and having that kind of power, that kind of speed, that kind of burst, that kind of sudden acceleration comes with, you know, a downside. And it's, can your body take what it's able to generate? For Robert, unfortunately, that answer has been no a couple of times in his big league career. And what I want, and I think White Sox fans, and I know Robert and the White Sox want more than anything else, is for those injuries to be behind him and for him to be able to go out and show everybody what he's capable of doing and be the cornerstone of a White Sox offense and defense up there in center field. But we'd love to see it first. You know, that's the thing he's got to prove to himself and to everybody else. Now, and that's not to say that there's, you know, a lack of anything when it comes to Robert. You can go through all of the workouts, all of the, you know, the post-game and the pre-game prep, all of the everything, and still be waylaid by things that are not your fault or were just bad luck. I mean, shoot, you think back to, I mean, there's hundreds of players, right, who have just come back from some sort of soft tissue injury and they could get plunked on the wrist and break one of the bird bones in their hands. And then that's another, you know, month and a half or whatever it is. That stuff happens in baseball. That's part of the game. And there are only so many things you can protect yourself from. But for the White Sox, whether it's the near-term future or long-term future of the franchise, a lot of it has to do with what Luis Robert is able to give to this team. Whether that's because he's able to produce for the White Sox or whether, and I think this is more less likely, whether that needs to be Robert producing for the White Sox so that he can be traded to another team and the White Sox can add what they need for the next few years, that matters too. And I don't think the franchise is at that point. I don't think that Robert is necessarily a guy that even if he, you know, let's say he comes back and plays the best 2 months of baseball that he could possibly play heading into the August 1st trade deadline. I don't know that the White Sox are there when it comes to, is Robert the guy we trade to really kickstart and change what this franchise looks like from a minor league standpoint and bring in more talent to supplement the next couple of years. I think Robert's still a next phase away, whatever that looks like to you. But you'd still like to see that baseball played from a lot of different perspectives, and none the least of which are providing some more wins for this ball club right now. And that's something the White Sox are looking to do this afternoon with a 3-10 start against the Milwaukee Brewers, snapping that 9-game losing streak. When we come back, we'll talk about Garrett Crochet. He gets the start today. We'll also be talking later on in the show about a big change in Major League Baseball when it comes to record keeping, stat keeping. We'll get it all into the show right here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Waddle and Sylvie, weekdays, 2:30 to 6:30, ESPN Chicago.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight. White Sox and Brewers coming up at 3:10 this afternoon. The pregame show starts in about 36 minutes. 2:30 start for our pregame show. Garrett Crochet starts for the White Sox. Robert Gasser for the Brewers. Tell you about something special going on at the ballpark later on this month, now that we're in June, in just 10 seconds. We'll pause it here for station identification.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WSHE HD2 Chicago.
A Good Karma Brands radio station.
You should be at the ballpark on Friday, June 28th, to see country music artist Jordan Davis perform a post-game concert presented by Coca-Cola after the White Sox take on the Rockies at 6:10 p.m. Don't miss your chance for an up-close, on-field experience. Exclusive field dirt passes are on sale now with limited availability. To buy field passes, visit whitesox.com/concert. We're going to take a quick break. Went a little long in the last segment, but when we get back, I want to talk about one of the big changes to Major League Baseball's record-keeping that was announced earlier this week. The statistics from the Negro Leagues have been included into MLB.com's registry. And that's not just a thing where, oh, look, they're on MLB.com now. Oh, no. The players are now in season leader lists, in league leader lists, lifetime achievements, all this other kind of stuff. These players of legend are now kind of, you know, made real here on MLB.com. It is a long time coming. It's an endeavor that has absolutely been painstaking here over the last 3 years. I've listened to some interviews from guys like John Thorne, Major League Baseball's official historian, Larry Lester, one of the historians for Seamheads and the Negro League Museum. And I mean, he's just done a ton, years, decades even, of research into that organization's past and history and even in some ways its future. And I'll relate what I know. I would love to hear your thoughts on this as well. Maybe some of your favorite players who are now included in MLB.com's registry with the Negro League stats now part and codified in the numbers and why it happened too. Some good sound from MLB Network as well. We'll bring that all to you when we come back. This is Connor McKnight and White Sox Weekly on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The ESPN Chicago app.
Welcome back to White Sox Weekly here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I'm Connor McKnight. White Sox and Brewers coming up at 3:10 this afternoon. Our pregame show begins at 2:30. White Sox Weekly until then. Our pleasure to have been joined by Michael Huff, the director of youth baseball for the White Sox, earlier on the show. Each and every one of our episodes are downloadable on the ESPN Chicago app. You can go and download the app, download the shows, and listen to all the interviews from the last couple of weeks. There's been some good stuff. Not that we've done much, but the interviews that we got are good. Brian Ramos was on the show. The assistant general manager of the White Sox, Josh Barfield, was on the show. We grabbed the latest from White Sox general manager Chris Getz when he had his press availability just the other week. Missed any of that stuff? You can go back and listen through it. Right there, available for you on the ESPN Chicago app. Also, Sox fans, now through June 7th, save up to 50% off an all-inclusive pregame patio party for select games. Take advantage of this amazing deal and enjoy 2 hours of all-you-can-eat and drink starting at $40. That's not a typo. Yeah, no, it's $40. It's not a typo. That's an incredible deal. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/patio deal. You may have heard Len and DJ and I on the broadcast at different times talking about the cheeseburger that is available for you on the patio at White Sox games. It's well, I'll tell you what, I wish we had one here at the house right now. I mean, it is. Oh my goodness, that's a sandwich is what it is. You should go out and get yourself one, and you could by going to whitesox.com/patio deal. All you can eat and drink starting at $40 for a White Sox games. Now, one of the things, a huge headline here over the last week, and Len and DJ and I have talked about it quite a bit, whether it's been on air or off air, because it's just so fascinating, has been Major League Baseball's inclusion of Negro League stats into the official register. I have read a lot about this. I've listened to interviews with John Thorne, the MLB official historian, with Larry Lester, another historian, primarily of the Negro Leagues themselves, but has also done a lot of work, I gather, with MLB. And I'll let the folks at MLB Network kind of update you on where this came from. This is kind of, the official announcement of it, an explainer for it, and then we'll kind of work through it too, because there's so much about this that I was unaware of, and a lot of different tentacles here in terms of the inclusion of these stats that make this a fascinating, overdue, and interesting conversation when it comes to what these men were able to accomplish in the Negro Leagues back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Here's a little bit from MLB Network earlier this week.
Several new Major League records are now held by Hall of Famer Josh Gibson, who is being joined on the all-time Major League leaderboards by several other Negro League stars. The stats of more than 2,300 Negro League ball players from 1920 to 1948 launched today in a newly integrated MLB.com database that combines seven different Negro Leagues from that period, along with the American League, the National League, and other major leagues throughout history. This effort is going to allow fans to view the stats and records of Negro League alumni as easily as all other historical Major League players. And it just became official on the website a few moments ago. And let's take a look at how the stats and the records now look. So Josh Gibson now
ahead of Ty Cobb
as the highest career batting average leader. Yeah, so the players highlighted in addition to Gibson are from the Negro Leagues. Oscar Charleston, Judd Wilson, Turkey Stearns, who hit 348. So, I mean, Josh Gibson, I feel like it's a name that that we've known, familiar with his exploits, but there's so many other players that now we get a chance to see them in a whole brand new light and context. Buck Leonard, now on this list of career OPS leaders. Josh Gibson, ahead of Babe Ruth, ahead of Ted Williams, and Buck Leonard there rounding out the list just behind Barry Bonds. And one more, lowest single season ERA. Tim Keefe, Dutch Leonard, they're at the top. But look right ahead of three-finger Mordecai Brown, Satchel Paige, an ERA of just over one in the season of 1944.
I mean, baseball wasn't integrated until 1947. Black ball players couldn't play in the major leagues. Right. And you and I were just talking about this in the commercial break. It wasn't like now in present day when players say, I'm going to play in Japan or Korea. They couldn't play in the major leagues, and now their stats count. Yeah. This is a huge day.
That's from MLB Network earlier this week as they unveiled the inclusion of those players and their statistics on the official MLB.com database. Now, Baseball Reference, it just kind of to walk you through this as best I can, and I will not proclaim to be the expert on this. That is, those are much smarter seam heads than I am. But on Baseball Reference and Fangraphs, for a little while now, you've been able to go through and peruse the stats of Negro League players and other players from other professional leagues, same way as you can now from MLB.com. But it's worth noting, and John Thorne, baseball's official historian, definitely has, MLB.com is the official place where these records are kept and held, right? It may be, in some instances, the way that Baseball Reference or Fangraphs relates some of the box score data or some of these statistics themselves are just a little bit different than they are at MLB.com. MLB.com is the official one, right? And both of those sites, Fangraphs and Baseball Reference, are fantastic tools, and I shouldn't have to tell you again, but I could not do my job without them. So many of us couldn't. We rely on them day to day for our baseball broadcasts, as we do MLB.com and the official register. What I didn't realize until this was announced earlier this week, and what I, you know, kind of felt like was a blind spot in my baseball history understanding and knowledge, was kind of what went into deciding which stats were included and have been included for decades now. As I understand it, and I may have just a little bit of the detail wrong, and I apologize if I do, but this is a long and winding history. It's kind of like giving someone the oral history of the Bible and then going, I'm pretty sure I have a lot of this right, but you know, maybe you've got a different one than I do. There was a committee in 1969 where baseball decided which leagues would be considered having been major leagues, right? And at that point, things like Major League Baseball, the American League, the National League, the Federal Association, and the Union Association, among others, were all considered Major League Baseball. The Negro Leagues were not. That is obviously, and I think it's Lauren Shahadi on MLB Network, the female voice you're hearing at the end of that little clip we played for you, that's very clearly what she's referencing here. These men were not allowed to play in what was deemed at that time Major League Baseball. They did not have that choice of going over to play in Japan or what have you, right? I mean, that wasn't available to them as it was to a lot of baseball players in the 1970s and 80s and 90s or what have you. You know, different places to go play professional baseball. This is what black baseball players had available to them from 1920 to 1948. And even at that point, struggles were there, right? I mean, we know the history of this game. We know the history of this country as it pertains to black players in baseball. To have these stats and names considered as some of the best in the business over the course of their careers is monumental, right? Josh Gibson is your new career batting average leader. He was a 372 hitter in his career in the Negro Leagues. What's also meaningful here, and it's something that we've talked about some on the broadcast earlier this week, and something that I find meaningful too, and I'll reference this to you. Effectively Wild is one of my favorite baseball podcasts. It's the Fangraphs podcast, or one of them. Ben Lindbergh and Meg Rowley host the podcast. And on their show last week, they hosted John Thorne and Larry Lester in a long interview about this change, about these stats, about the history of this league, all other sorts of stuff. I learned a ton and really enjoyed the interview. And what I didn't realize is the contention that some of these formerly or currently considered professional leagues had. For instance, the Union Association is a Major League Baseball league. You know, it's considered Major League Baseball on MLB.com, has been on FanGraphs and on, you know, Baseball Reference for years now. The Union Association lasted for only one season, 1884. St. Louis won the pennant and won the National League the following season. From what I can understand, the St. Louis Maroons, who won that season, eventually ended up becoming the St. Louis franchise that we kind of have known and loved. It moved around a little bit. There have been changes, right? The whole thing. And you know the history of expansion and relocation and all this other kind of stuff. But that gives you the St. Louis franchise that eventually is the founding St. Louis franchise in Major League Baseball. And that's why the Union Association, which existed for, again, one season in 1884, was deemed a professional league and included into Major League Baseball. Those are the kinds of leagues that have already existed in Major League Baseball's official stat record for decades. Why? You know, what meaning does that have? What relevance does what somebody hit in 1884 have on whether or not a single season leader should be considered one or the other? Very little. But, I mean, my contention would be, if that league constitutes a professional league and stats worth holding next to Tony Gwynn's lifetime batting average or Ty Cobb's single season high batting average or Rogers Hornsby's single season high in RBI, then certainly the Negro Leagues, which existed from 1920 to 1948 and had some of the nation's best players in it, deserve to be considered in the same way. There aren't problems here. It's just, to me, a matter of labeling things. When you look through, whether it's MLB.com or Baseball Reference or whatever, and you see a team name that doesn't make sense to you, like the New York Superbas, right? You go, okay, well, that was clearly a different league and a different time and a different place, but it is considered a major league. Same way for these players and these stats, and it makes a whole lot of sense. What I also didn't realize, again, I'll push this interview again. It's highly worth your time because the four people talking about this are some of the, I think, four smartest people in and around baseball: Larry Lester, John Thorne, Ben Lindbergh, and Meg Rowley. What I didn't realize and what Lester brought up in this interview was that the overall league stats from the Negro Leagues compared to Major League Baseball from 1920 to 1948, right? Like the league batting average, the league ERAs, those kinds of, you know, watermark stats for what a league looks like were largely the same for the entirety of that league's existence. Which is to say, at least from my estimation, that you're seeing some really similar baseball in both places. And there have been conversations and criticisms, I guess, of, well, sure, the Negro Leagues had some great players, but did, you know, was it representative? Was it the same level of talent of Major League Baseball? After all, Major League Baseball had been around for so long, even up to 1920, there were better. I don't know that that's the case. And I just learned this over the last week. I mean, it's really a cool history to now be included in the official record of MLB.com. I find the whole thing absolutely amazing and completely fascinating. Quite frankly, a little depressing at times, reading back through the history of this league and this country and who decided what and who got to be official and who didn't. It is altogether surprising and unsurprising at the same time. And yet, you know, being able to kind of read through these stories is awesome. It really is. One of the sayings that John Thorne, the official baseball historian, official MLB historian, has is stats are shorthand for stories, right? When we say 755, we know what we're talking about. When we say 714, we know. And those stats come with, in some places, actual asterisks, which have had to be removed from record books. They come with qualifiers and caveats. They come with a story of a 1998 summer that was riveting for baseball fans all across the country. When they needed it most, you had the home run chase. And yet, that history is tainted by the use of player performance-enhancing drugs throughout the league, not just by some of the players involved in that chase, but throughout the league. And I think when, at least from my perspective, whether we're talking about the Hall of Fame or the official record, as it were, on MLB.com, I want to treat the history of baseball as the history of baseball. Let's actually talk about what these players went through, what these players accomplished, where they failed. Like, I want all of that involved in the conversation. I'm not interested in necessarily cherry-picking through just the brightest stories and the heroic finishes, right? I mean, I think back to, and I don't know how you feel about the Robert Redford movie, The Natural. I find it a little long and kind of arduous to get through. But at the end of the book, he strikes out. At the end of the movie, he hits the homer off the light standard and the fireworks and the explosion and everything. Both are incredible endings, but they teach completely different lessons at the end of the thing. And I think baseball has that way of, you know, kind of being able to teach those different lessons through sport, through a connective tissue, through a national pastime that, regardless of your interest in baseball, we use in everyday language, right? I mean, your boss has probably said, oh, let's hit a home run on this one, right? But you know that she's not a baseball fan. Or your boss has said, don't strike out on this appraisal, but he's not a baseball fan. His kids all play soccer or whatever it is. But it's in part of our language. It's in part of how we talk to one another. It's in part of how this country relates to what works, what doesn't work, what's good, what's not good, all this other kind of stuff. And I am so encouraged and so glad to have this as part of the official record, to have these seven Negro leagues considered as part of the national record. And that's a really cool development for Major League Baseball, to say nothing of the fact that the committee, there's a 16 or 17 person committee that's worked really hard to include the right stats into this. And I guess that's the last part too, right? These leagues existed from 1920 until 1948. And regardless of where you were or who you were, record keeping from 1920 to 1948 is a little bit different than entering a box score onto a website that gets populated all across the world instantly, right? And has a certain data fidelity that you don't have to worry about. But what I think what's interesting to note here is that games that have been storied to have happened, right? There's a home run that Willie Mays hit in Birmingham while he was playing there and as a member of the Negro Leagues that was, I don't know, rumored to go like 7,000 feet or something like that, right? We've got news stories of that game and of that home run, but there is not a box score from that game. And therefore, that game is not included in the official stats. They want box scores. There's a story about Josh Gibson hitting four home runs in a game, right? And there is no box score for that game. Therefore, those four home runs are not attributed to Gibson. The stories of Gibson hitting 800 home runs in his career. The stories of Satchel Paige having thrown 50 no-hitters and winning 2,000 games, those are stories. And what this committee has done is input the box scores, the actual data, into, as best they can find it, into this database. And I guess, from what Larry Lester has said, about 75 or 80% of the data is accounted for, the games are accounted for. They feel really good about the data they were able to put in and have cross-checked it all and made sure that, you know, that the runs scored in a particular game is also reflected by the runs allowed in a particular game. All these things. And it matters so much, because if you're going to do this, do it right. And they certainly have to this point. And the endeavor is ongoing, right? History is a process, and this is part of the process, including these things that happen at a major league level, now officially. We've got the White Sox pregame show coming up in just a little bit. We'll start that at 2:30. A little bit more White Sox Weekly on the other side of a quick break. I'm Connor McKnight. It's the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Cap and Jay Hood, Monday morning at 7, ESPN Chicago.
Learn from the pros this summer at a White Sox summer camp presented by Wintrust. Starting at $165, kids ages 5 through 12 can register for a four-day baseball camp offered at over 35 locations throughout the Chicagoland area. To learn more, visit whitesox.com/play. I'm Connor McKnight. You're listening to White Sox Weekly, at least for just another couple minutes here on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. White Sox and Brewers are getting set to play the Game 2 of this three-game series at American Family Field in Milwaukee. Our lineups are out. We'll get you those in just a moment. We'll give you both sides, too, because you got to wait a while for DJ to get both of them to you. And pregame show coming up in just a bit. You'll hear from White Sox manager Pedro Grifol and Len Casper, of course. Leading off for the White Sox today, Tommy Pham, then Corey Lee. He'll catch. Corey Julks in right. Paul DeJong will DH. Gavin Sheets at first, Lenin Sosa at third. Andrew Benintendi in left, Danny Mendick at second base, and Zach Remillard will hit nine and be the shortstop with DeJong, the designated hitter. Joey Ortiz leads off for the Brewers. He's one of the players, one of two, that the Brewers got back in the Corbin Burns deal that sent Burns to Baltimore. William Contreras will catch and bat second. Christian Yelich in left field and batting third. Willie Adames at short. Reese Hoskins at first. Gary Sanchez, designated hitter. Blake Perkins in center field. Jackson Churio, one of the top prospects in baseball, struggling to get it started here in his first taste of big league action this season. But Churio signed a huge extension in the offseason. He'll play right field and bat eight. Bryce Terang will bat nine and play second base. Now, the White Sox were beaten by the Brewers last night. 12-5 the final. 23 hits for the Brewers. But the White Sox have Garrett Crochet on the bump this afternoon. And Garrett has been pitching exceptionally well. I'm looking forward to seeing what Crochet's got for the Brewers and their contact bats. He's got a whole bunch of velocity, and here's hoping he's able to get it by him. The pregame show starts in just a little bit, but you can learn. You already learned from the pros. Kick off NASCAR's Chicago Street Race. Join us on Sunday, June 30th, for NASCAR Day, presented by Skill. For a limited time, receive a number 34 White Sox Michael McDowell shirt when you purchase a specially priced ticket. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/NASCAR. Big thanks to Kendra Smith and Brendan Riley. The pregame show's next on the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.